Yeah, so my first book, Legacide, which is 10 years old in October this year, the premise of that is that innovation, we could say relevance as well, though, doesn't come when you start doing something new. It comes when you stop doing something old. And that's the core premise of Legacide, is that legacy thinking is the silent killer of innovation. We are not. We are the product of our past successes, but our future will not be built on them. And we've got to figure out new ways of doing things. And the only way to do that is to solve new problems, I believe. And again, I'm not the authority. I'm just, this is the only way that I can figure it out.
Welcome to the Expansive Podcast. Today we have another very special episode, an episode with a new guest that we haven't had on, but that we have hope to have on many more times in the future. But before we get to him, you can wait for a few seconds. John, how are you doing, brother? How was Africa Burn?
Yeah, Eric, good. Very good, thanks. I was bumped into a bunch of people that listened to the pod there, and they all send their regards. And we had some deep chats on that, what's it called? The Plier, about the pod. And it was so great. You know what? One of the things that really touched me is a few people came and thanked me for the pod. It was a deep, sincere thanks. The guy was like, I really appreciate what you guys are doing. I had a lady come up to me and say, I so enjoy it. We listen to it with the family. And I'd never really heard it like that real like gratitude for the pod, because I guess we're so operationally involved trying to build it and grow it and sponsors, and we never actually think about the impact. And that was really wonderful. So everybody that I met at the Plier and at the Burn that listened to the pod, thank you so much. Really appreciate all those kind words, and we look forward to adding more value as much as we can. And this is exactly why we have Rich with us here today.
Listen, wait. Yeah, I need to ask something first. Are you getting old? Because you tapped out on day four of like day six or seven, right?
Yes, that is true. I tapped out on day three, in fact. And then I had friends of mine. Yeah, day three. They're like, I was like, I'm leaving. They're like, no, stay. I'm like, no, I'm out. So they convinced me. And then day four again, I was like, okay, I'm out. I'm leaving. It's enough. And eventually I got out of there. I had to get out of there secretly. Nobody wanted me to leave because I was like, no way, the party's starting. This DJ's playing. Do you know, I don't know if it's my age or not, but I don't give a shit for these DJs, bro. I don't care. It's like people are so enthralled by it. And this guy's come from the other side of the world. I'm like, I don't know. It's just not my world anymore. So it was a really good time. I don't know if I'm going to do it again. I think the definition of that sort of energy has changed for me. You know, I remember riding the bicycle on West Palm Beach, which I hired for a few days after I left Tony Robbins. And I absolutely loved riding my bicycle around West Palm Beach. It was beautiful. It was so connecting. It was so peaceful. And I'd much rather have done that. So I don't know. I think as you get older, you have to start to redefine what it looks like, you know?
Yeah, things change. Yeah. You can't be the 70-year-old guy at the nightclub at some point. You know, I think you have to evolve a little
bit. It gets a bit sad. You know, it does get a bit sad eventually. Definitely. You know what I mean? I think it does. But one person did say to me, did Eric take a mushroom ceremony? Is that why you were so shy about explaining what he was doing? And they were laughing at me, telling you that was the most pathetic share we've ever heard. They were laughing.
Yeah, it was. I've had that feedback as well.
Have you?
Listen, so yeah, I've had that feedback.
Anyway, let's get on to our guest.
On to our guest, our very special guest for today. I met Rich, many, many years ago, probably about 2016, 2017-ish. And I don't quite remember how we connected. I actually think I reached out to him because I remember looking up to this speaker who was doing so well and speaking all over the show. And he spoke for my brother and them at Microsoft, and you know, just heard how phenomenal a speaker he is, and also how much he swears on stage, which I think has changed. but I remember that being a key feature of Rich. And then we connected. He was one of the first readers of the daily email that I was sending out to him, Better Man. And I just remember, like, we attended an event once. I think it was a Heavy Chef event. And Rich was speaking on the day. What was it around? Like innovation or something, right? So giving the talk, and then somewhere in the middle of the talk, he like gives a shout out to my daily email. And I just remember feeling so like wowed by it. Like this guy that I've always looked up to, admired for everything he's done, is giving me a shout out in front of all these people on this like incredible stage that he has. And that to me has become the defining feature of how I know Rich, which is an incredibly generous person. someone who is generous with his ideas, someone who is generous with his time. And since then, sat with me many times to talk through ideas and talk through books and talk through talks. Like, he's the public speaker's speaker, right? Like, he trains guys on how to do well on stage and how to deliver messages in ways that actually have an impact. And so with all that said, that's my introduction to Rich, John.
Okay, let's just call him Richard Mulholland, firstly. And Richard, you can talk. Just say hi, yes. So we can, while we're upping you here.
Yeah, no, it's nice. I'll just sit back and let you guys do this. I'm feeling wonderful. I actually was close to tears there, Eric. Thank you.
Yes, and Richard has softened, but I think we all have, actually. So let me tell you a little bit about how I know Richard Mulholland. I remember being at my restaurant and this guy coming with all these tattoos and loud and always like energy around him. And then I got invited to go watch him do a talk and I was blown away. It was so good, so awesome. It was Think Sales at Monte Cassino. That was the first time I saw you, Rich. And I was just so impressed, you know. And in fact, Rich became my North Star of wanting to become a speaker, you know. And he was the guy that I didn't want to emulate, but I could see the level of success that he was having and I was so excited by it. And so we've had our journey together and I'm very glad to say that we're good friends and share quite openly and quite generously with each other and what's going on for us and how we're building our brands and how we're growing. And it's really a wonderful relationship for me because we've had our ups and downs and we've matured and softened and are much more encouraged to help each other now than ever before. And so it's a real pleasure to have you on the pod, Rich, and it's been a long time coming to get you on here. So welcome, Richard Mulholland.
Thanks so much, lads. Oh, what a privilege. You know, I mean, I'm a fan of the pod, which is really nice. In fact, it's because of you that I use the term pod as opposed to podcast. I never heard that before, but now I'm like, oh, I'm on the pod.
You know, on the pod. Really cool.
Yeah, it's really okay, great. And it's funny, I always have to remind myself that when I'm listening to you guys, and then I remember, like, these are my good friends. Like, it's kind of cool. And I love the work that you're doing, and it's obviously just incredibly cool to get the chance to share this time with you now.
Well, you know, we have this thing that we've created called Friends of the Pod. And you, Rich, even though you're the first time here, Eric and I were thinking about who we want to be friends of the pod. And you definitely are the one of the friends and somebody that we want on often, sharing with us what's going on in the world, bringing a topic to the table and having you also just being a third person, just to give your perspective on those topics. And we really do appreciate that. So even though it's your first time, welcome to Friends of Pod. And we look forward to lots of that moving forward.
So I was thinking of this Friends of Expansive, Friends of the Pod, when you were chatting to Rowan the other day. And I thought, no, man, you're missing a trick. So this is terrible. Surely it should be Expansive Friends because they're friends that are expansive as opposed to Friends of Expansive. And so I was thinking like, hey, we've got some expansive friends and we're bringing them on. Anyway, use it, don't use it. But that was my thought.
Here we go. And before we even started, you see, this is Rich. He's already shifted.
Yeah, yeah.
Eric, call the agency, get them to change the branding. It's now called Expansive Friends. Thank you, Rich.
Rich, I think, you know, so we have lots of jumping in points that we can start with. I actually want to know what changed for you in terms of going from like being the guy who swears a lot on stage. And I know that you've gone through a bit of a transition with that. What happened? Why did you decide to clean it
Jasmine.
Up?
Jasmine. That's the answer.
It's totally part of the answer. So Jasmine definitely calmed me down. I married a lady that is much more excitable and frenetic than I am. And I don't think a relationship can exist with two people with the exact same energy. There needs to be complementary energies. And I recognized very early on, and so I'm going to take you on a side tangent. So Jazz and I were about 3 weeks together. We were driving back from Pretoria. We'd met friends of hers and something happened. We had our first argument and she started shouting at me in the car because she's a little ball of fire. And I shouted back and then she stopped and she said, what was that? I said, well, what do you mean, what was that? It was like the most surreal thing. She said, you're shouting at me. I said, no, I'm shouting back at you. And she's like, well, you're not allowed to. And I was like, what? And she said, look at you. I'm tiny and like you can't shout at me. That's not on. I said, but you shouted at me. She said, yes, we're fighting. I was like, I don't understand this game. Terry said to me, no, I'm not allowing you to shout at me. I said, well, this is fucking ridiculous. Like I'm shouting, we're having a fight. She says, no, I won't have you shout at me in a fight. I said, well, then we can't be together. She said, fine. And then, you know, I dropped her off and I went back to my flat in Joburg and I was sitting there and I thought about it. I thought, well, this is, I mean, I really like her and I don't really like shouting at people. So I sat there for a few hours and then I had to like sit with my pride for a bit and then I let my pride go. And I phoned her and I said, like, I can't promise anything, but I'm willing to give it a good go. And she was like, cool, acceptable. And so I stopped shouting. I stopped being that guy. And incidentally, it was only during COVID, possibly 2020, where she'd actually shouted at me once in an argument. And about a week later, I said, hey, listen, remember I stopped shouting. I was about the same age as you are now. How about we become a no shouting household? And she was like, yeah, that sounds good. And so now we don't shout. Anyway, this energy thing, that was definitely something. So that calmed me down. The other thing is that I remember I spoke at an event called Net Profit. And the first year I spoke, I actually went back and I re-listened to the talk just to see. And I said, fuck, I think it was seven, I can't remember exactly now, but it was less than 10 times. And everyone came up to me the year later. And even the MC, when he introduced me, is like, oh, watch your ears, the foul mouth speaker, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, and people were coming up to me saying, oh, you're the guy who swore a lot. And everyone would swear to me because they'd want to come up and show, like, bro, I'm in your clan. And so they would F-bomb me just for fun.
I'm like you.
And I thought, yeah. What a terrible thing to be remembered for. Like, that's it. That's my cheap trick. And I recognize now, Don, my old business partner, used to pick up on me. If I was delivering a new talk and I was nervous, I would swear more. Because swearing is a cheap laugh. You drop it at the right time, and it's an easy way to get a laugh. And so if I was nervous, I'd lean into that. So that was my canary in the coal mine that, oh, I'm a little bit nervous, I'm swearing more. I don't have any regrets. I now realize how hard it is to be known as a speaker, to be remembered for anything. So actually, in retrospect, I look back and think, okay, that was well-timed. And in a time when nobody was really swearing on stage, that was me and I had tattoos and it kind of had a bit of a brand. But as I'm getting older, I'm turning 50 this year, that's definitely not what I want to be known for. You know, geez, how depressing. And I think we have to evolve. As John, it's exactly what you said in the intro about who you were at Africa Burn. You know, we're not the same person. And thank goodness for that. Like, we're figuring out and we're being more appropriate to current things in our life. So, yeah, that was a very long answer to a very short question.
Yeah, no, it's a perfect answer. It's a perfect answer. Yeah. And you've also recently made a huge move in your life. And before we get into the topic that really... I mean, I literally woke up this morning thinking about your topic, which is so weird. I never really think about you, especially when I wake up.
It's terrible.
But you've just made a massive move in your life. Tell us a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, we moved to the Isle of Man in the end of February this year. I've been here now basically 3 months and loving it. Although I don't think I've been on the island more than 3 weeks at a time or more than 2 weeks at a time since I've moved here, which is a flaw, right? If you're going to move to somewhere, I'm all for moving and traveling and being nomadic. John, I don't know if you felt this when you moved to Dubai or Eric, when you moved to Cape Town, but it's quite, when you're trying to become part of something, leaving it constantly makes it quite difficult. If I could give advice to somebody or even to me, if it was possible in my job, when you land somewhere, you have a no-fly zone for 3 months. Just be where you are. And I think that was the one mistake I made. But you know, it's whatever. But I see how much more settled Jazz is and Bailey. They're just where they are. They're just figuring this place out, which is kind of cool. And I love it, but I recognize that I'm in the honeymoon phase.
Yeah, that's great. I know. I think building community in a new place needs time. And, you know, just WhatsApping a friend to meet somebody somewhere, to be invited to that party. I find when I'm in Dubai for a while, that starts to pick up and then obviously it loses. And then I come back to Cape Town and I don't even have a TO. So it does feel quite lonely, you know, even though you're based somewhere, you really are out of the routine of with many of your friends, you know.
As I got older, I've leant more into the phrase of being an introvert. almost too much, I think. And I started becoming a bit of a definition for me. So because I tell people, it's like when I wasn't drinking, I stopped drinking when I was 19, but I only realized I stopped drinking when I was 20 or so. Like it wasn't intentional. But then by the time I was 27, I was like a vehement anti-drinker. And then when I became an atheist, you know, when you first become it, you're vehement this. I think I went through the phase of trying to identify as being an introvert. And I think pathologizing anything, naming anything, counterintuitively is a bad thing because then it becomes part of your identity. So when I arrived here, I decided, well, first of all proactivity comes to me. It doesn't serve me at all to say, well, I'm an introvert. I've got to wait for people to reach out to me. So I am the person who reaches out to everybody because I recognize that I'm in anybody that I'm become friendly with here, I'm interrupting their life, right? So they existed just fine without me. I'm an interruption, and therefore, until such time as I'm part of their life and their, I have to be the person that sends the messages, even if it's the first five times. I can't wait and say, well, I asked them last time. And so that's what I've become. I've decided that, sure, I recharge when I'm at home with my family, but it's up to me. I'm the nobody who's coming into their existence, and I have to show up like that. So I parked the introvert identity behind me.
That is such a small nuance that I also have to do. I also have to keep doing that. It's like I always have to reach out. And thank you for saying that. That's actually made me feel a lot better because I also think to myself, geez, I'm bugging these people. They're already doing – they don't actually need me at their – but yeah, slowly but surely you start to add value like that softly. But thank you for that. That makes me feel a lot better for my sort of private WhatsApping sort of process. Eric, sorry, I interjected.
I think – no, I think it's just like it's a constant tapping into community, which is very difficult. You know, when we landed in Somerset West, the thing that integrated us the quickest out of everything was joining like paddle clubs. And because of that, like and sports, I think in general, just a very good connector of people. And so because of that, like our time to like our immersion time in Somerset West, I think was almost cut in half. Like we got to meet so many different people who run businesses. Like because of that, I walk into bakeries where I know people. I walk into like wine farms where I know owners of wine farms, all because of paddle. And then I've noticed, you know, so like a few weeks ago, I had this shoulder issue and I had to stop playing paddle for about 6 weeks. And it was almost like I couldn't find a game after that. Like when I came back to it, I was like, how do I, like, who, no one wants to play with me. Like, I realized that it was on me to just reach back out and get those games organized and make sure that I'm not the one just waiting for people to invite me, but I'm the instigator of collaboration. And in my talk, actually, like this is a big part of it, as I say that we have to be good collaborators, which is like in the moment, how do we collaborate well? But we also have to be good instigators of collaboration. Like if you want to have a high collaborative intelligence, it requires both of those things at the same time. I wanted to come back to something you said, Rich, though, around like not naming things because, so you said like, we shouldn't name things because it becomes us, right? That's kind of the gist of it, right? There's a professor called Dan Siegel, and I cite his work quite often. And his entire thing is you have to name it to tame it, which is, I think there's a nice interplay here. But I think on the one hand, what we're trying to avoid is labeling ourselves as X. And in the same breath, if we can identify, if we can name, like, this is the thing that's keeping me trapped. This is the identity that I've created that's preventing me from doing X, Y, or Z. Now that I've named it, I can do something about it because the naming of it is also the self-awareness that we're creating, right? So if we don't have the awareness around the thing, we can't do anything about it. It's why we go to the doctor. It's like, I have this pain in the side of my stomach. I want him to name it, diagnose it. And once he's named it, I can go, okay, now I know what to do about it.
So I'm not sure I totally agree because I think it's very, very hard for people to separate. I think one of the biggest problems of the world, one of the biggest problems of the world today, I'm still turning 50 this year, so it's really funny. But I think this naming of things is terrible. Is my daughter came in to me, she's bad at spelling, and she's an avid reader, like 60, 70 books a year kind of reader. And she came in and she said, Dad, I think I'm dyslexic. And I said, why do you think you're dyslexic? She said, no, because I can't spell. I said, well, maybe you can't spell. And maybe because you just not tried getting good at spelling. So no, that can be it. And I kept on saying to her, Bailey, why do you want to pathologize this? Why do you want to own an identity that you have a thing? So we were going through this and we went through it, and actually there's no chance that that's what it is for her. And then I looked at, like, can you learn to spell? It's a learnable thing. It's like a sport, right? And people learn it. And so what she wanted is permission to be bad at something, permission to not work hard at this. Well, I can't do this because I am X. And so I think there's a negative utility value with naming things for most people. If you are expansive, right? If you are choosing to live the way that I think the three of us are currently choosing to live our lives, then sure, we can settle with it and recognize it as part of the attributes, the character sheet that we are, and then it's fine. But most people don't do that. They just take it on and say, huh, okay, cool. I am an introverted, dyslexic thing. And you see it right now. If I'm a neurodivergent, this and next thing, gay. Like, I don't understand. Like, none of these things define who you are. They're just attributes of who you are. You should only be defined by, you know, your character and how you behave. And so sometimes I think they're unhelpful. I think there's a slight... Shit, Eric, I'm sure there are times when it makes sense to understand, like, you know, this is a problem and we should live with it. But I think we need to know the inherent risks that come with that too.
Well, I think the thing that, I think the real key for what Dr. Siegel or Professor Siegel said is to tame it, not to release power and relinquish power to it. And I think that's the real key. And I think the approach, the how you, and so I think in some places it's necessary to overcome it. But I do think that most people will do it just to want to release and say, okay, well, you know, I'm introverted. I never message anybody. That's my story. I'm never going to message anybody. I'm just going to sit and stew in my own loneliness. And so, yeah, it gives us the permission sometimes.
Yeah.
Sorry?
What's the opposite of expansive?
Shrinkage.
Yeah, I would guess. Contraction. Because I think that's what... Contraction, contractive, or whatever. So I think some people, that's what they're trying to do. They label it. Because I really do. I mean, I didn't throw in the name of the podcast here, you know, just as a thing. I think it's true. So some people, they want to use this identity to contract their lives, to make it smaller. They want a package. They want a neat package. Like, oh, I'm this, da, 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 da. Whereas what I'm trying to do is to make, yes, I'm introverted, but if this was small like this, watch on YouTube if you want to see what I'm doing. If this was small like this, then introversion becomes a big part of my identity. But once I recognize that I'm big, like a balloon, if I wrote introvert on a shrunk balloon, okay, and I wrote all the basic attributes, introverted this is the next thing. If I blow up the balloon, those things become smaller, and everything that's interesting to me is figuring out what's in the rest of the balloon as I expand. But most people want to use it the other way. They want to contract it right down to the deflated balloon version and then say, oh, introverted, neurodivergent, this. And then you become a very, very small individual to me.
I remember a lady in France, I was doing a talk, and she stood up and defended her anxiousness. And she said, I suffer from anxiousness, and this is why it's so important, and I don't want to let go of it. Because it gives you license to act in certain ways and, you know, to move in other ways. But yeah, I think the approach is obviously the key. I want to jump on, I mean, we've only got a few, like 20 minutes to go, but I really want to jump on your keynote topic at the moment, Richard. I do love it. I love how it comes off the tongue, and it's so, so relevant. And tell us about it and tell us what you're doing about it and some of the principles around it. I'd love to learn some more.
So John, I mean... You are a big part of what brought this about in a kind of roundabout way. You joined an organization called Impact 11. You told me about it. I thought, okay, let me see what this is about. I attended an event last year. And as a speaker, I've been very lucky in that, generally speaking, and it's kind of, I think, the position you want to be in as a professional speaker, is that people come out to you and they book you. They don't book your talk. So generally speaking, somebody will come out there, they'll book me, we'll have a chat, and they've tied me up. And then only in the briefing call will we decide what I'm going to speak about. And that's a great place to be. And it's fantastic, but it only works if you're established. Now, I want to do a lot more in the US. And again, John, you introduced me to GDA, and I listed myself with them, and they asked me to give my talks, and I gave, you know, my favorite seven, and they've never booked me. And it makes sense, because if you have an absolute stranger, and the stranger is, you've given them seven data points, seven tiny little country lanes at the intersection of many, many different topics, they're never going to find you. And when I was sitting at that Impact 11, I thought, "Phew, I've made myself very hard to find for people who don't know who I am." So if you know the actor Richard is quite hard to sell, but the movie Relentless Relevance isn't. So I started thinking about what would a topic be that I care enough about to really hang my hat on, to be, this is the topic I want to be known for. And last year, I started becoming quite obsessed with this idea of relevance, of my relevance, my company's relevance. And I think it's the topic that we've ignored almost more than any other at the moment, is that we think about innovation and we think about purpose, but like this idea of why, like what's your why? Your why is fucking unimportant if the world doesn't care about it, right? So if you have a purpose that is so aligned with where the world is today, and then the world moves on tomorrow, and your purpose isn't relevant to the matter or appropriate to the matter of hand, it doesn't. You can live your life's purpose as if it's your reason for being, but then nobody cares anymore. And I mentioned it twice already. I'm turning 50 this year, and guys, I'm petrified. To be frank, I'm more afraid than I've ever been in my life of a number of things. I've all of a sudden become afraid of dying, which is quite a weird thing. It's something I'm trying to get my head around. And I'm afraid of retiring because, like, there's work to be done to make sure I retire without being a burden to my children. And I'm afraid of irrelevance. I'm afraid that the world won't give a shit about my ideas anymore and about my thinking anymore. And I'm scared that they won't care about my business or that I will no longer be needed in my business. And so these are things that I've been struggling with. And I realized that if I'm struggling with them, then everybody else is. So that's the first part. The second part is that relevance used to be a waypoint on the journey of life. It used to be every now and then you had to check your relevance, you know, every few years, am I still relevant? Am I still relevant? But it's exhausting now. Now being relevant is the road. We travel on Relevance Boulevard. It's not the waypoint anymore. It's the road that we travel. And that's why the most interesting part of the talk is the relentless part of it. So relentless relevance felt like I believe it should be a core value of every business in the world today. If relentless relevance isn't one of your core values, I think you're in a problem.
Yeah, so it's really talking about adaptation in a new way. It's like really how fluid are you in adapting to what the world requires? And does it also include what are your steps in evolving yourself? Like what are you doing within yourself to adapt to what the world needs that's still in line with who you are in some way? Can you talk about those two sort of separate things in some way?
Yeah, so I think it's very important to understand, you know, you've got to be narrow about things. There's so much going on. It's very, very difficult time because how do you not jump onto every trend? How do you learn to ignore the 100 things that happened and only focus on the one? And the way you do that is you stay clear to your own victory condition. So what is the problem I'm trying to solve? And the way that you do that is you recognize that we're not actually playing an infinite game. We're playing a series of finite games. The shorter the length of the game that you are currently playing, the easier it is for you to change. So that is a big thing for me. Right now, I play an annual game. So I'm every year, I'm kind of playing a game in my business. And every year, I reassess what is the victory condition of this game. I play that game as well as I possibly can. The only thing that I'm trying to do is to get closer to the victory condition, to get closer to X. And I utilize my values as a means to do that. In the future, I recognize that I'll probably have to have a shorter game. And of course, it will be a longer, bigger game that you're playing inside it. But it's quite unimportant because that long game, that far outlook is going to hold you. It's going to be harder to achieve in the short term because of the changes that are happening in the world. So that's how I personally do it. I'm not sure that I've solved for it yet, but this is how I'm currently doing it. You guys? Similar?
I can't answer that for you right now because I have a question top of mind, which is how do we assess whether we are relevant? Like what is that metric or what is that, how do we figure that out for ourselves?
You have to ask yourself, am I solving a problem worth solving? Because that's all it is, right? All we are is solutions to problems. That's our entire existence is, when I get on stage, I'm only on stage because somebody recognized that I can help the audience solve a problem that they're currently dealing with. That's it. That's all, everything. When somebody hires Missing Link, they have a presentation problem. There's a big pitch that they have to win and we've got to help them solve it. If we are not appropriate to the matter of hand, that's a big problem. So I think we've got to go through a flow chart of questions. Question number one, we've got to look at what it is we do and ask ourselves, what problem were we, because we become solution centric, and that's a fuck up. Right? We mustn't ever fall in love with the solution. We must always be in love with the problem. So the first question we have to ask ourselves is, what problem were we solving? And then we've got to be very clear on that. When we started doing X, when we wrote this keynote, when we created this product, then we've got to ask ourselves the second question, which is, does this problem still exist? Now, I cannot tell you how often we run this with corporates. And then the answer to that particular process or system, the answer is no. The problem doesn't exist because the world solved it. Well, then stop doing it. If the answer is yes, we've got to ask ourselves the next question, which is the way we're currently solving it, is our solution still the best way? The counter narrative to that is, if you broke away from this company or if you were starting from scratch again, would you solve it the same way? If the answer is yes, great, stick to it. If the answer is no, then we have to change. And I think we have to constantly repeat those questions to ourselves over and over and over again. The only thing we have to figure out is, what is the matter at hand? What is the current problem we're solving?
Do you have an example from your own life where you felt like you were trending towards irrelevance and then because of these questions, you were able to recalibrate back to relevance?
Well, there's been many. So again, having all of those talks, just to not have to go into a whole other case study, having all of those talks was great and it served me very, very well in South Africa where people knew, but they booked me before. I've been on their stages 3 or 4 times. I had to solve a problem to make myself hireable for them again. So let's get Rich back because it was a good time and everybody enjoyed him. So I had to write new keynotes, new information, new things because I had to make sure that I was solving their problem, which was, how can we bring this guy back? Whereas now when I go to the US, that's not a problem they have. They don't have in fact, the problem they have is that they don't care about who I am at all. I am a beautiful grain of sand lying on the beach. My job is not to build my brand, but to build the brand of the problem that I'm solving, the dragon I'm trying to slay.
Yep.
And that's why every single video, every single article I write, the word relevance has to appear somewhere. Because that's all I'm trying to do is I'm trying to shine the light at the dragon that I'm trying to slay in the world. If the world then believes that that exists, then they'll find me.
And do you think in order to be relevant, you have to release old versions of yourself and old ideas of yourself? Because much of it is, yes, you have to do something new, but you also have to let go of something, right? So where are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, so my first book, Legacide, which is 10 years old in October this year, the premise of that is that innovation, we could say relevance as well, though, doesn't come when you start doing something new. It comes when you stop doing something old.
That's right.
That's the core premise of Legacide, is that legacy thinking is the silent killer of innovation. We are the product of our past successes, but our future will not be built on them. And we've got to figure out new ways of doing things. And the only way to do that is to solve new problems, I believe. And again, I'm not the authority. I'm just, this is the only way that I can figure it out.
I think the hardest part for me around this is the releasing of, you know, it's like we get so caught up in our identities and our ideas and our behaviors and our personalities. And in fact, like we said earlier, things that we've named. And we're like, okay, no, I'm that guy. I'm that girl. I do these things this way. I'm never going to do it any other way. And I think it's always questioning those. And I think relevance is consistently questioning who I am. Like, who am I? What am I doing here? Does it make sense for me to see that person as an enemy or as a friend or that situation as a challenge or something that I just want to actually just jump into? And really redefining who you are through this process is both the most energizing but also the most difficult.
And there's a cheat code to that. And whether we know it or not, well, whether you've thought about it or not, both of you have figured this out. And the cheat code for us is writing new books. Think about it. What book defines you best currently? Your first book or your current
latest.
Book? Your latest,
no, latest
book, right?
Of
course, so, yeah. And in fact, often what happens as thinkers, we start getting defined by the unwritten book. So, and that's what I do is you have to be very, very careful how long you milk the product of the book that went by. And I recognize, so my last book, Here Be Dragons, was on sales. And I was really excited about it for a while. And we wrote it because that product, that idea was trending in my brain. But now already I'm defining myself on the unwritten books that are ahead of me. And that's exciting for me because it makes me open to it. Maybe it's wrong, but I'm bored of the books of the past.
You know, I got asked to go and speak. I mean, in fact, next week I'm speaking in Durban on What's Your Moonshot. I'm like, dude, I don't even remember what's in What's Your Moonshot. I've forgotten what's in it.
You know what's nice, though, as a speaker, for me anyways, I had to retire content. I have this bit of content that I've just recently brought back in, and it was probably my first bit of my, ironically, own content, and it was a bit on the book Reimagined by Tom Peters. And I had this really funny bit that I did with American music played and my fellow Americans, and I walked into the stage, and I did this big thing. And one day I woke up, and I realized the audiences aren't loving this anymore. They're so bored of this content. And then I thought, well, they can't be bored of it. That's ridiculous. And then I realized, oh, no, you're just bored delivering it. And our first law of presenting is, we call it the Amsterdam Principle. And it's that an audience can never enjoy receiving a presentation more than you enjoy delivering it. But you know what the nice thing is sometimes you can go back and shag an old fling and it can be fun again, right? And so that's what happens, John, when you go and find the bits of the moonshot talk that brought you the most joy. And when you're on stage again, you're gonna have this, you know, we all understand the back channel, the voice in your head that's happening while you're speaking, the person who's talking to you, and you're going to be delivering this content, my fellow Americans. You're going to be like, I'm loving this. And then it's still part of you. And so I love reintroducing old content, but I love reintroducing old content with new relevance.
Also, I think What's Your Moonshot is the one that really put you on the map, John. So, like, there's also just go and bathe in the gratitude for what it gave you. put all the books in a tub and just lie in it for a while until it's like soaks into you.
But you know, it's so funny. It's almost like I was sitting at NASA. I was speaking at NASA, and I almost wrote out my future in my book in some way. It's like almost like while I was sitting there listening to the vice president of NASA talk, I was like, oh my God. The opening page of What's Your Moonshot of JFK's speech about putting a man on the moon. And I was like, wow, here I am literally working on a project called Vision 2040, putting a self-sustaining city on the moon. I was like, I can't believe this. Like I kind of almost wrote my reality into reality, you know? And I think that's also a good practice to do with our books sometimes. You know?
Rich, so speaking about relevance, I think a trap that people can very easily fall into, and that I think we see all the time as well, is that you might perpetually be looking for your relevance. You know, so like, I mean, your framework is quite clear. It's like, you know what problem you are solving, the ways that you are solving it, make sure that it's relevant to your customer, make sure that it's relevant to the times that you are in. But I think very often we develop a bit of shiny object syndrome to feel relevant. Like, okay, artificial intelligence has just come out. It's everywhere. Everyone is like, how do you implement it into your business? I'm not relevant if I'm not using artificial intelligence. And so like now we go on this like journey for how do I get this into my business? But of course, like that's not what it's about. It's not about this perpetual like shifting of what you are doing all the time. Like you have to kind of find your lane. In a very convoluted way, what I'm trying to like ask you is when it comes to relevance, how do we kind of prevent this shiny object syndrome bouncing around between thousands of different things because we feel like this is relevant now this is relevant, now this is relevant? Like it feels like a very like almost impossible but also exhaustion-inducing chase.
So I actually talked about this when I did the talk the first time for Mark Sham. And in that talk, I spoke about the Stanley Cup problem, not the ice hockey one that's just going on now, but the Stanley Cup trend. And I think we have to be very careful about jumping to trends. I realized that, so I'm
sorry, can you unpack the Stanley Cup trend? I don't know it. I don't understand.
So the Stanley Cup trend was there's Stanley, the company that makes,
Oh, you mean those things? Yes, got it. I thought you meant there was some sports called the Stanley Cup.
Okay, so, yeah. Like a golfing cup. Everybody wanted to have these cups. And so it's quite funny. I was hired to speak at a company and they'd seen a video of my talk. It was the second week. So I'd done it the first week. They'd booked me to do the talk before seeing it. They watched the recording and then they said, listen, we need you to take the Stanley Cup content out because we bought everybody Stanley Cups as their gift. And because I was saying the Stanley Cups went up so quickly and then they went down. Now, if you're trend hopping today, you'll never win. Trend hopping is exhausting and it's actually irrelevant. Trends come and go. We are not trying to spike trends. What we're trying to do, and this is where I look to futurists, people like John, to give me my insights, is I'm not trying to figure out what the futurist job is to sort through and to try give me the long point, not, hey, every little thing that's happening, is what is the thing that's happening far enough away that allows me to ignore lots of the other things. The second thing is that I think that becomes very problematic. If you want to use AI, fantastic. I love using AI, but I'm very narrow in my focus to it. So I use AI over and over and over again, but actually I use ChatGPT. I chat. So my favorite podcast, my favorite pod, is probably Conversations I Have with ChatGPT, especially now because of the personalization. So now I've given it memory. I've told it exactly who I am. I am Richard Mulholland. I'm a speaker. This is who I am. And it knows, like already, if I said, it knows my provocative nature, things like this. I've said how I want it to address me in the tone of language. And when I'm driving, I have really cool debates with it. So I've become very good at a single AI. I see these groups. I'm on an EO group for AI. And I look at it and it's just exhausting. Everyone's trying to stay up to date with everything. That is a curse. If you want to be irrelevant, try stay up to date with everything. So what I'm trying to do is within an area, become pretty good at part of it and ignore the rest. You've got to be very, very good at ignoring. It's like, I think it was a few episodes ago, you guys ended with this idea of focus. Do you remember that? What we actually have to learn to do is to focus. We've got to learn to focus well. And I think
that's right. Yes.
I think that's what we have to understand, which of these tools, how can I become better at a single tool rather than trying to become, you know, have a passing knowledge of everything. It's why I ignore the news and it's why I ignore most of these reports around AI and things like that. I tap in every now and then. So once a month, I allow myself a couple of hours to explore the latest tools, the latest things, and I parse them based on their readiness to serve me today. I just one last thing on this AI thing. I had a fun use case. Mostly a hate relationship with Jordan Peterson. I love listening to him just to hate him because it's just, and I'm just like, fuck you, man. I'm like, come on. And so I debate him all the time and I recognize that he is a master of debate, but I think he's a terrible public speaker. But I was debating, he had this belief that we need religion to you know, all morals come from religion, which I think is terrible. But I was thinking about, and he says, because you need a god, an entity. And then, so I started thinking about Shintoism, the Japanese religion, that is basically a belief in spirits, kami, rather than a god. So I went into ChatGPT and I started chatting. I said, hey, if I was debating, and so we're having this conversation with the voice prompt as I'm driving. And then about 20 minutes in, I said, okay, do me a favor. From this point on, you're Jordan Peterson. I want to have a debate with you. This is the topic. You've heard everything that I've already said. You're opening the debate. The only rule of this debate is we're not allowed answers longer than 30 seconds. The next voice to speak is you. Go. And then from driving past about Century City and to my meeting at the Vineyard Hotel, Jordan Peterson and I had a debate. And it was amazing. And so just using this one little tool, that's all I need right now. And I recognize that some people will think that I'm not doing a good job and not staying relevant. But for now, I want to master one tool. And using it as a debate engine is a fantastic way of doing that. Sorry, that went very long.
No, Richard, you're always, every time I meet you, dude, every single time, you always have thought about something so deeply, crisscrossed it with yourself, and then you present it in a way I'm like, wow, just so well thought through. I feel enriched every time I spend time with you, and I'm so grateful that you've been on the pod. I love that. I'm actually going to do that myself. I'm going to debate you, Rich, and I'll let you know how you've done. Oh, it was fantastic, man. I feel really great. I'm already waiting for the next time you're going to be on the pod.
I feel as enriched.
That was good.
Yeah. To both of you all the time. All the time. And every single time I drive away from either of you, my brain's on fire.
Awesome.
A measure for the pod always is how much fun do we have on it? That's like right. when we finish, that's all it comes down to is did we enjoy it? And we know that if we enjoyed it and if we enjoyed listening to it and hearing the insights, then our audience will have the same experience.
Absolutely.
So thank you for that. It was absolutely amazing having you on the pod today. And to any closing thoughts quickly, like you have 20 seconds each. John?
No, I don't want to close. Rich, you close, bro.
I love the idea that you're doing a podcast that is an extended conversation between two people. I think the world needs more of those things. I think, in fact, it's what we've kind of learned in the podcast that we're trying to launch, Middle Ages Men. And I love the idea of allowing guests every now and then, but I come for the two of you. That's why I listen. That's why I'm a fan of the pod. And so thank you for that. And make sure you don't overcook the ratio. Then you just become one of everybody else. It's the John and Eric show that I love.
Exactly. Thank you so much. And thank you to everybody that's checked in again this week. We will resume a normal
broadcasting.
Jeez, but I'm still in Africa Burn, obviously. Resume normal broadcasting next week. Lots of love to you, Richard. Thank you so much for coming on board. And for everybody out there, Richard Mulholland is how you'll find him. He's all over social media and always adding value.